Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Amateur Traveler, episode 552. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about ducal palaces, ancient churches and theaters and universities, as well as star-crossed lovers, as we go to northern Italy, to the cities of Mantua, Padua, and Verona. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. If you're listening to this when it comes out, I'm actually in Israel or on a plane there, but we got this show out so you could listen to it and not have a week off. We'll be talking about that more later, I am sure, but for now, let's talk about Northern Italy. I'd like to welcome to the show Gina Musio, who blogs about Italy at ginamusio.com, and there'll be a link in your show notes in case you don't know how to spell Musio. That's M-U-S-S-I-O. Gina, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Gina blogs about Italy, so oddly enough, we're going to talk about Italy. So we're going to talk, actually, Gina pitched me some destinations in between Milan and Venice. So in that great trip where you fly into Milan and you're heading off to Venice, we're going to tell you what to do in between.
Where to begin? Yeah, absolutely.
So first, you're in Italy, actually.
Yeah, I am. I live here. I live near to Milan. And I'm able to explore a lot this area.
And what brought you to Italy besides a plane?
Well, I came to study the language, and I stayed because I married an Italian.
There's usually a story like that involved.
Mm-hmm. It's a classic.
And you pitched me this particular region of Italy. Why are we going here?
I think that when people focus on the smaller towns of Italy, they often focus on the smaller towns of Tuscany. Mm-hmm. Which are incredible, but living in Lombardy, I've been able to explore a lot of the small towns here and in this region, let's say, like we said, from Milan to Venice. I wanted to show people that they are worth a visit also, and some of them are just as beautiful and just as historic and have just as delicious food as the hill towns of Tuscany.
Excellent. And what kind of itinerary do you recommend?
If you have a week... And we're not going to include neither Milan or Venice in that week. We're going to pretend that you have more time for those cities. I think a route from Milan to Venice, stopping in Mantua, Verona, and Padua along the way are perfect points to stop at. That's the order that you're going in, or in reverse if you're coming from Venice.
Okay. And I should say, somebody commented to me about a recent episode with they felt like we were rushing something because they were trying to fit in a week. That's a constraint that comes from me. So we're not going to blame Gina for that. She's cheating a little bit by carving out Milan and Venice as separate places, but it's absolutely worth it. We've done separate shows on both Milan and on Venice and the Veneto. So let's hit your itinerary. Where are we going first?
Our first stop is Mantua. It's had a hit in popularity. Last year, in 2016, it was the European Capital of Culture. And this year, it's declared the European Capital of Gastronomy, which is actually my favorite reason to go there. It's along the way, a little bit underneath Verona. It's actually quite near to Verona, which makes our second stop easy. But Mantua is this wonderful little town in the fields of Lombardy. It's actually the only of these three towns still in Lombardy. The other two are in Veneto. It has a ton of history. It's actually the hometown of the poet Virgil. Vivaldi, the composer, lived there. It was where Romeo was exiled to in Romeo and Juliet. Mm-hmm. So it has a lot of references in Italian history and culture in its history personally. It's actually been made such an interesting city, I think, by the Gonzaga family, which is basically Mantua's Medici family, if anyone knows anything about Florence history. Mm-hmm. They were big and powerful and very, very rich. And a lot of the things to see are the things that they brought or built in Mantua.
And you mentioned that we're going to contrast this with the hill towns of Tuscany. This is not a hill town.
No, actually, it's quite flat. And mm-hmm. its geography is really important. It's also important for that gastronomy title because it is basically built on the convergence point of three lakes. These lakes are created by the Mincho River, which is a tributary of the Po. The Po River runs across the entire region. And all of that to say that it sits on these lakes and a lot of its food comes from that. So freshwater fish, frogs, and water-intensive agriculture. So rice, pumpkins, when you have a lot of fields and open fields, these are the things that you'll find there in the restaurants.
And the Po River Valley being one of the early places that was settled in Italy and also one of the most fertile places in Italy.
Yeah, and it still is very fertile. Visitors can kind of take part in the geography a little bit more by taking boat tours up and down the river and kind of around the city. There are different options there. And also bike tours, which I've never done but heavily recommend because they say it's spectacular. You can rent a bike and basically go all around the city, on the outskirts of the city, following the river path. Well, and that should be really beautiful.
And we did an episode about biking in Tuscany a long time ago. But honestly, the Po River Valley is more my speed, a large flatland for bicycling.
Yes, exactly. It's flat. I mean, you can do almost as many kilometers as you want, as many miles as you want. But I would say, for example, this is very family friendly. Also, it's not for hardcore cyclists. You can do short distances, and like you said, it's flat.
We'll send them off to Tuscany.
Yeah.
So what are we doing in Mantua?
Well, you can start in Piazza Sordello, which is one of the principal piazzas of the city, if not the main piazza. And there you'll have the Duomo,
the town. Cathedral.
Exactly, the town's cathedral. And Palazzo Ducale, which is the royal palace of the Gonzaga family. It is a behemoth.
Palace.
It has more than 500 rooms.
Oh, my.
And they say it's something like 7 football fields big. you can spend an entire day in there. You probably won't want to. A lot of the rooms are empty, and you just kind of gape at the opulence and how beautiful it is. But there are some interesting things. For example, inside there's the Camera dei Sposi, which is the wedding chamber, mm-hmm. let's say, painted by Andrea Mantegna, which was basically the court artist, a Renaissance painter, for years and years and years in Mantua. He lived and worked there. And he painted these frescoes on the entire wall, the ceiling, everything of the family, of the Gonzaga family.
Hmm. We're
Hidden
doing
gardens.
This all on a tour, I'm assuming.
You can do it on a tour or not.
Oh, you can do it independently. Okay.
Yeah, you can do it independently. I think you'll get a lot more out of it if you do a tour.
Okay.
For sure, unless you really research it beforehand.
Okay.
And on the outskirts of the city, but be careful, it's completely within walking distance. It's not so far. The city's not so big, but they call it the suburbs of the city. There's Palazzo Te, which is another Gonzaga family palace. It was originally actually their stables because it was originally in the countryside. And they converted it to house special guests and royal guests and use it as office space. That is also really beautiful because you can find other frescoes there. For example, the Camera dei Giganti, which is the Room of the Giants. And there you see floor-to-ceiling frescoes of the giants who were thrown out of Olympia after they tried to overtake Zeus. And it's quite powerful.
My impression just from pictures, and I haven't been there in person, is this is something akin to what you would have in the Sistine Chapel, that kind of effect of art everywhere, except possibly without bodies everywhere.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, floor to ceiling, but also on the ceilings, not insignificant frescoes. These are made by, like I said, Mantegna, which is a very important Renaissance painter. Mm-hmm. Actually, his Lamentation over the Dead Christ is in a museum in Milan, and it's very famous for its unique angle of Christ as a corpse when he was dead. Yeah, exactly. And you will most likely enjoy it with very few other people. It depends on when you go. Obviously, August will be a bit more crowded, but in general, you won't have to worry about fighting the crowds.
Okay.
Besides that, there's a Teatro Bibbiena, or the Bibbiena Theater. It's entirely made out of wood, and it's a beautiful theater just simply to visit. But it's also significant because they say that it was kind of Mozart's debut. As a 13 or 14-year-old, he played in that theater, and him and his father are quoted discussing how beautiful it is.
In all my life, I've never seen more beautiful of its kind.
Exactly. Wow, you're very prepared. Obviously, there are a lot of churches to visit, as in all Italian towns. I really like the Rotonda because now it's a deconsecrated church. And they actually sometimes have little shops and other things in it. Mm-hmm. But it's very particular. It's round and it's filled with frescoes from the Byzantine era. So it's a little bit different. It's also Mantova's oldest church.
Okay. Yeah, I see it dates from the late 11th century. So that is pretty old. Brick.
Yeah. So those are the major sites that you're going to see. If you have the desire for a slight day trip, just outside of the city is the Sabbioneta. It is considered the ideal Renaissance town. It was made by one of the many Gonzagas as a fortified city. And because it was created basically from the ground up and not built on top of another town, he was able to create it exactly how he wanted it in his ideal image of what a Renaissance city would be. That, with Mantova's city center, is a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Excellent. You kind of buried the lead there. We usually talk about that in the first part that we're taking you to some UNESCO World Heritage Sites, but excellent.
I think besides that, we want to spend our time eating. I think Mantova has absolutely incredible local cuisine. It's very specific to the city that everyone absolutely has to try. When in Mantova, you should eat at an osteria. An osteria is a place that serves wine and simple food, but now it has grown to focus a little bit more on the food and a little bit less on the wine. Originally, you would basically only go for wine with little snacks. Now they'll have real meals, but the menus are still quite short with an emphasis on local ingredients. This is your typical mom and pop place.
Do you have a favorite osteria in Mantua?
I do, actually. I haven't eaten at all of them, but we went to one that was incredible, friendly, painted with bright yellow walls. We spent 2.5 hours there, and it's called the Antica Osteria ai Ranari. I think the translation is fishermen of frogs, like frog catchers.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So actually, one of their specialties are frog legs, which is a classic in Mantova also. If you want the frog legs, I suggest you get there earlier because we did a late lunch and they were all sold out for the day.
Okay.
But there you can find all the other Mantovan classics. So pumpkin tortelli or tortelli alla zucca. These are little raviolis, little tortelli filled with pumpkin and all the special ingredients, obviously. Or risotto alla pilota, which is a special kind of risotto or rice for this region. Mm-hmm. And it has sausage in it, usually. And here in Mantova, as well as Verona, where we will go to next, you can get a lot of game or something even more kind of particular. You can eat donkey or horse.
Okay.
Yeah, so you can get a brasato or a stufato, which is a way to say meat cooked for hours and hours and hours and hours of either donkey or horse, if you're interested.
Tends to be something more popular in Europe than in the U.S., I would have to say.
I agree. The horse has a very strong flavor. If you want to try without jumping out too far, I would suggest the donkey. It's something a little bit more normal.
Okay.
There is, in September, a festival of literature. You have to book in advance if you want to go, but they do 5 days of readings and book signings and discussions and in all things literature.
Italian?
In Mantova. Predominantly in Italian, okay. But they will for sure have also English okay. options. The website is in both languages, so I assume that they do both.
Well, and you mentioned 2 different months. September might be attractive because of the festival, although it also is going to be a little harder to book. August, you've recommended we avoid because it's Europe, it's August. It's yeah, hotter, it's hot. And it's crowded, more crowded, and it's more expensive. But other than that, is there a best yeah. time of year? Do you have a favorite time of year in the region?
So I think the region can be visited all year long, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Fairly mild winters because we're further north here.
Yes, so I think you can visit all year long. But because we are in the north and because it is a very humid area
yeah.
surrounded by lakes and whatnot, I would choose, if I could, from spring to fall with maybe a gap in August,
okay.
if possible. These are the best times. In the spring and fall, you will have excellent weather. Summer can be very hot in these areas, all three of these towns. But there are lots of fun things to do in the summer. The best food is also found in those seasons. So in Mantova, okay. the best pumpkin tortelli will be in autumn, obviously.
Sure.
And in spring, you'll find more dishes made with local herbs, spring greens, these kind of things, asparagus.
Well, and it's probably worth mentioning, although I'm sure we've mentioned it on the show before in one of the many, many episodes we've done on Italy. In an Italian restaurant, the menu will change seasonally because of the availability of fresh ingredients. And so if the pumpkin really appealed to you, then yes, you want to go in the fall. So.
Absolutely, absolutely. And especially if you eat in an osteria or these mm-hmm. very small local mom and pop places. They have what they have. Like I said, the frog legs were out by the time we right. went there because they had their stock for the day. And same goes with the produce. So it will change based on when you're there, for sure.
Excellent.
From here, we go to Verona. Most famous for Romeo and Juliet, obviously. Actually, Verona has a lot to see and do, I think, even more so. You'll probably start in Piazza Bra, which is the main piazza, where you will see the arena of Verona, the Verona Arena. It looks just like a little Colosseum. And in fact, it was a little Roman Colosseum. It was actually built before the Colosseum, and it was built by the Romans. It's essentially a prototype. It's a 2,000-year-old structure built sometime around 30 AD, they believe. And I'm completely fascinated with the Arena of Verona, with its history. Throughout the years, it was a gladiator ring, a public trial area, a theater, an open-air market. It housed apartments for the destitute, let's say, prostitutes, the down and out. It was sacked and raided in the Middle Ages for its materials. And now it serves as an amphitheater for opera performances.
Huh.
And this is why I suggest the summer. The summer is hot. Especially in Verona, it seems to hold heat. But every summer, they have their summer festival season, and they hold operas in the Verona Arena. This is really particular because it is not closed. So you are outside, mm-hmm. open-air arena, and the performers sing without microphones.
Wow. Okay.
It's really incredible. I mean, the architecture was done so well that the performers are able to sing even to this day without microphones. And no matter where you are, you can hear them perfectly.
Hmm.
So these operas are really nice because you might be coming from Milan, where they have La Scala, where you can hear an opera only if you have a certain amount of money, a certain dress code, a certain time of year. But the Verona Opera is really open to anyone, everyone. You can pay to sit in a plush red seat on the ground, and that will be more, minimum 100 euro, I would say. Or you can sit on the amphitheater stone seats, and there you pay around 25 euro. So it's really available to everyone.
Well, it looks like it seats about 15,000 people, so...
Mm-hmm. 15 to 20,000, they say, still. even though the final ring of the arena did break and mm-hmm. doesn't exist anymore. It was once there. It was once an arena that held 30,000
right.
people. Yes, you have all of these stone seating. I suggest bringing a blanket or a pillow to yeah. sit on, because operas are very yeah. long and stone is not comfortable. And there's another reason. It is very hot. So the stone soaks in the hot summer sun all day long and then releases it at night while you are sitting on top of it. So dress accordingly and maybe have something to sit on. That said, it is very pleasant. It is very fun. The atmosphere is great. Because anyone is invited, you're sure to make friends with whomever you're sitting next to. Probably it will be a German. They have a lot of Austrians and Germans who come down to Verona on short trips and enjoy operas. And I've actually seen 3 operas in the arena. Hmm. Each one excellent. Also, I'd say if opera is not your thing, because you're only spending 25 euro, you could also just go for half the time to get an idea of it, to get the feel of it, to see if you like it, because some operas can run 4 hours. Others are a typical two-hour festival, and in that case, it might be easier. They give you candles to light before. As the sun goes down, as they're preparing to begin, everyone lights the candles and a hush comes over the crowd and you prepare to hear the composer begin. And it's really, really something to experience.
Excellent. What else are we doing in mm-hmm. Verona?
That is at night. So during the day, you're going to go see Romeo and Juliet's house. You're not going to put gum or write on the wall of her house, as you'll see hundreds and hundreds of people do, because it actually costs the city a lot of money to clean that up. And even though people do it, they actually don't want you to do that. So you're not going to do that, but you will touch the breast of Juliet. Yes, absolutely. There's a statue outside of the house. And you'll know which one to touch because it's been discolored from all the people who have done it. And that's considered good luck. So you'll do that before touring her house and seeing her balcony. You'll also go to Piazza delle Erbe, which is the second major piazza. It's absolutely beautiful. The architecture, the houses that surround it, show really Verona's wealth, because every house is completely different with different colors and designs on them, which only a city that was very rich at the time could afford to do. Mm-hmm. And they've maintained it to this day, and it's beautiful. It's also a really great place for an aperitivo, an Italian happy hour, where you can get a cocktail or a glass of wine and some salty snacks and enjoy the early evening. You will be with all the other Italians who are doing that at that time.
I should say that we have talked about Verona, too, on another episode that talked about Venice and the Veneto. So if you're looking for a picture of what we're talking about here and don't have the iTunes enhanced version where you're seeing one right now, you can go look at back to episode 182.
Perfect. One thing that is particular with Piazza delle Erbe is that you will see hanging a very large bone, and they say it's a whale bone, and it's hanging there. Supposedly it will fall, I believe, if the right person walks under it.
Sounds like the wrong person walks under it, but...
yeah. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't have said that until I re-researched it, because it's been a while. But it's this very, very large bone hanging up, so you can try to search for that on a sort of scavenger hunt while you're in the city. Verona is also a really good place to shop if you want to do that. They have beautiful shops. I usually just go to enjoy the atmosphere. Also, while you're there, there are many churches to see. Two of the most famous and most beautiful are the San Zeno Basilica mm-hmm. and the San Lorenzo Basilica. They're two of the biggest basilicas in the city and a large part of its history. Now, if you're in Verona for a few days and you want to explore, maybe you have a car, you can take a day trip to Lake Garda, which is nearby. The Garda Lake is a huge lake in northern Italy. It's very important and it's very beautiful, absolutely beautiful, especially if it's a nice day. So you can drive maybe 30 minutes to the lake. And all of the towns around the lake are really gorgeous. I really like Sirmione, but it depends on how far you want to drive.
Okay, so I had to look up the bone. According to legend, the whalebone should fall on the first truthful and just person to walk through, but so far the old bone has stayed put.
Yes, it's still there. It's absolutely still there. So,
and the origin is debated. It may have been brought back by soldiers. It may have been brought back by crusaders. They don't remember what the story is. Interesting. And doesn't speak well for the truthfulness of the people in Verona, I have to say.
No, nor for the tourists who go, because I've walked under the bone many times. It's never fallen. So there's that. So another interesting thing about Verona is now we're in Veneto. We're officially in the Veneto region. Mantova is in Lombardy and Verona is in Veneto. And it shows you just how different the Veneto cuisine is based on where you are. So whereas in Venice, you will get fish, obviously, a lot of seafood. In Verona, you will get heavier meat-based meals. And this is actually where I would suggest trying the donkey if you are in Verona and you're willing to try it. A donkey ragu will be offered at every restaurant, and I think it's really quite good and also particular. So if you wanted to try that, you can try it in Verona.
Okay. Before we leave Verona, I should give a nod here to the other two Shakespeare plays that we didn't talk about, which are also set in Verona, which are obviously Two Gentlemen of Verona. But less obviously, Taming of the Shrew is also set in Verona.
Oh, that's right. It's true. Well, this is a Shakespeare-rich area.
Yes.
Also with Mantua, and I'm sure if you go to the Literature Festival, you'll hear about that also.
Excellent.
All right. So we either get on the train or back on the A4 highway, and we make our way from Verona to Padova. The nice thing about this itinerary is that you're never in transit for long. Everything is relatively nearby, and especially if you are stopping to stay for a night or two, then you'll never notice really your long transits or wasted days, let's say.
Well, and you mentioned the option there of using the train or driving. It's an easy train ride. Obviously, that wouldn't give us the flexibility to get to some of the places you've mentioned out of town. And it's also an easy drive. Do you have a recommendation between the two?
Well, I live in Milan and I've always driven, and I've really enjoyed that and preferred that for the flexibility. Uh-huh. But I will say that all three of these cities are very easily reached by train. And if you want to take the 2-day trips that I mentioned, so the Sabbioneta from Mantova or Lake Garda from Verona, you can get to both of them easily by bus.
Okay.
Also, Lake Garda is a little bit further, so that you might have to look into. But the Sabbioneta is very near to Mantova, and they run buses frequently. So it is all doable by public transport, which I would say depends on how long you want to stay in each place.
Sure.
If in the end you're only going to stay one day in each place, maybe drive. If you stay multiple days, keep in mind that your car will be parked outside of the city. And unless you're sure to get a hotel with parking, you will have to pay for your parking. So keep that in mind when you're looking for B&Bs or hotels. All three of these cities are easily navigable. We're not talking about the center of Milan here. So the driving is quite easy and manageable if that's what you want to do. And that's what I've always done.
Okay.
So if you go on the highway from Verona to Padova, that's our final stop. Padova is a medieval city in Veneto. We're getting closer to the sea here. You can really see the Venetian Republic's influence on it in the architecture and the richness of the city. It's absolutely beautiful. I think the first stop in town is the main piazza, the number one piazza. It's called Prato delle Valle, Yard of Valleys. Once upon a time, it was covered in grass, and that was why it was called a valley. Then it was not for many, many years, and now it has an island in its center, surrounded by a moat, and the entire island is covered in grass.
Okay.
Which is very particular for an Italian piazza. They're usually cobblestones and bricks. This is actually the largest piazza or town square in all of Italy and one of the largest in Europe. It's 90,000 square meters. And for us, that's about 22 acres. And it's really beautiful. Here you'll see during the day, different markets selling both food and souvenirs, etc. And at night or non-market days, just the vastness of this piazza. It's definitely worth taking a stroll through. Also, the island in the middle of a piazza is very, very particular. From there, you'll explore the other things that Padova has to offer. For example, the botanical gardens. They say that the Padova botanical gardens are the oldest botanical gardens in all of the world, is what I've found. But they're certainly very old. In any case, they were started in the 16th centuries, and they're UNESCO World Heritage status.
Okay.
Started for the university, they originally had medicinal plants and only kind of useful plants. But now the gardens have 7 greenhouses filled with all kinds of plants. And not only that, but very well explained. If you take a stroll through these greenhouses, they have interactive signs and a lot of information. But you can actually do a tour also if you want.
Well, and you mentioned the university, the second oldest in Italy and one of the oldest in the world. And I think most people will know the name of at least one lecturer at the University of Padua.
Yes, absolutely. One lecturer is Galileo, who worked there supposedly for quite some time. So yes, second oldest university in all of Italy, right?
Mm-hmm.
From there, you can move on to the San Antonio Basilica. It's absolutely gorgeous. On the inside, it actually reminds me a little bit of Sacro Cœur in Paris because you can walk behind the altar. There's actually chapels and different rooms with relics all behind the altar that you can tour and pray in and visit. And thousands of pilgrims come every year actually to do that.
Well, we should say that both the two churches that you mentioned, Romanesque churches, I don't think we mentioned, because they're older. They're built in the 1100s, so they're quite old. Because this is obviously a very old and historic city. So
yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it's a medieval city, so older than the other two, older than Mantova, for example,
right?
And ruled by many different people. And yes, it has a large history. If we move to the Scrovegni Chapel, this is probably the most notable site. Why you want to come here? It is a chapel completed with frescoes from the 14th century by Giotto. So here you'll see the Last Judgment by Giotto, which is this terrible fresco of the devil and fighting, and it's emotional.
It is intended to influence you emotionally, yes.
Yes, exactly. And it's very well preserved and absolutely beautiful. I should say that if you don't book in advance, you won't see the Scrovegni Chapel. You want to call or book in advance online because this is regulated almost as much as the Last Supper in Milan.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, you have actually a climate-controlled chamber where you have to enter for a little bit to clean yourself of any bacteria, I suppose. And then you actually only have 15 minutes to view the frescoes. And it's all done in an effort to preserve the frescoes. So from there, I would go to stroll through the other three major piazzas of Padova. That's Piazza delle Erbe, Piazza della Frutta, or dei Frutti, and Piazza dei Signori.
That's Piazza of the Men. I assume women are now allowed. Piazza of the Fruit, so that's going to be a market. And Piazza del Erbe, and I don't know what that means.
Erbe is like grass.
Ah, okay.
So probably, or herbs. So probably a spice market.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Traditionally.
And in fact, yes, traditionally. In fact, they all three had major markets in them. And you can still find markets on different days, although I don't believe that they're as separated now as they once were.
Okay.
And here you'll find all of the town filling the piazzas for the famous aperitivo that I touched on just slightly in Verona. I think any visit to Padova has to have an aperitivo, a happy hour. You can't come to Veneto without getting a spritz. So around anywhere from 6 to 8, honestly, You can sit for a light cocktail or a glass of wine, or I suggest a spritz. And often it's accompanied by some light snacking. But the idea is to relax after a day of work, or relax because it's a weekend, or simply relax because you're in Italy. And in the Veneto, you should get a spritz because it is something you can find throughout all of Italy, but it's local to Veneto. So it was invented here. This is Prosecco, mm-hmm. sparkling water, and Aperol, which is like a bitter liqueur.
Oh, interesting.
mm-hmm. Sometimes made also with Campari. Both are red, orangish red. And if they ask you which you'd prefer, I think Aperol is the base, especially in the Veneto. But if they ask you which you prefer, Campari is even more bitter than Aperol. So the Aperol is a little bit easier, I think, going down.
Okay.
But it is a light cocktail. I mean, Prosecco, it's sparkling wine. So it's nothing to worry about, I'd say. And very refreshing. The food of Padova, it's quite similar to Venice's cuisine because it's very near to Venice. I think it's only 25 miles away, actually. But you will notice that you're a little bit further away from the sea. So here you can get the classic cucina povera, or peasant cuisine, mm-hmm. poor cuisine. So this is rice and peas, pasta and beans. These are classics because
meatless,
it is sure. a dish with both carbohydrates and protein. Mm-hmm. So it was perfect without the expensive meat of the time. In spring, you absolutely have to try the asparagus. It grows all around Padova. So they have both white and green asparagus, and you'll find a lot of dishes with that. Okay. And also radicchio, the bitter red lettuce. Mm-hmm. That is from Treviso, but Treviso is very near to Padova. And so it's a little bit of both places. As far as second courses, you'll find a lot of wild poultry. So pheasant, hens, these kind of things, and cooked in a variety of ways, and quite delicious, actually.
What is going to surprise me when I come to these regions, when I think I know Italy, but I'm coming here, is it going to be just very, very familiar? Is there anything that's different about these regions than other places we've talked about in Italy?
I think what's surprising is just how much history there is in each of these three cities, despite the fact that they're not particularly big. We made some comparisons with the Tuscan hill towns, which are beautiful and obviously rich in history. Mm-hmm. But here we have large ruling families that really brought in the best minds and artists of the time to decorate their villas and their palaces, to build magnificent basilicas, to really show off the city. And that's what you'll really find in these three towns, I think, which is why they often deserve more time than we give them, I think.
Well, you were talking about the rich history. I'm Googling like crazy while you're talking about places and keeping track of links that I'm going to remember later on and include in the show notes and all those things. And I'm reading through the history, and right now I'm in the middle of a book on the history of the Middle Ages, and so many of the names that I've been reading about had some influence in one of these towns. This is the place where the Ostrogoths had this battle, or Padua was basically sacked by Attila the Hun in 450, or, you know, all of these names that I have just been reading about were crisscrossing this region around the time of the Middle Ages. So even before the Renaissance period, which is what you're talking about, even before when things settled down a bit and people got a chance to do some art, there were all sorts
exactly.
of interesting things going on in this region, centered of both the Lombardic kingdoms as well as the Ostrogoths coming in, and the Huns, and all of these other peoples that we don't necessarily think of when we think of Italy. So,
yes, and being in northern Italy, it was ruled by a lot of different cultures. And also, I think all three, though they were their own strongholds, they, like you said, crisscrossed a lot and shared a lot of culture. So, for example, the Gonzaga family married into the Este family, which was from Ferrara, and melded those two together. And the more you scratch, the more you learn. If I feel like every time I go, I discover something new. That's really how I felt with the Verona Arena. The first time I went, I simply went and enjoyed an opera, and that was that. But right. after, I began to research more and more and more and realize that Verona was a Roman stronghold long before they had any other places in northern Italy. It was one of their first fortresses. And
well, and Padua even predates that. It's possibly the oldest town in northern Italy, founded around, I'm seeing a date here of around 1183 BC. By a Trojan prince who's basically fleeing from the Paul of Troy. So
oh, gosh.
There really is some incredibly rich history in the region. So interesting.
Right. So if that's something you're interested in, this is absolutely the place for you. I mean, it's fascinating. And like you said, any era, I think. And now you can also see why it was all three were important cities to control.
Sure,
so why right. people fought over them, not only because of the agriculture and the strategic location, but the background of all of them also showed a lot of power, I think.
The one that you know is going to be tough, you're standing in the prettiest spot in all three of these places. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
Okay, so I love the surrounding areas. I love the drive from one to the other is gorgeous, but I think the absolute prettiest spot is sitting on a stone slab that was built 2,000 years ago with the night sky overhead and the full force of the scenes and singing of an opera below us and 15,000 people with candles dotting the arena. That is absolutely the prettiest spot, I think,
Excellent.
Of these three towns.
One thing that makes you laugh and say only in these towns in northern Italy.
Visiting Palazzo Ducale in Mantova, we had visited after lunch, so post many bottles of wine. And my friend took it upon himself to slap on either side of the face of a statue with his hands, let's say, to grab the cheeks of this statue. He is Italian, by the way, not a touristic problem. And the guard immediately stopped him, obviously. But instead of yelling or kicking us out, we instantly began to talk about food and the guard's favorite place to eat and where we should go and the entire history of Mantovan food. And we left friends. So even though I don't recommend touching the statues, it turned out good for us. I'd say only in Italy are they jovial enough to do that.
That is not where I thought that conversation would go. Finish this thought. You really know you're in Padua, Verona, Mantua, when what?
You can find so much history and beauty in such small towns, and you find it while eating local, seasonal, delicious food.
Excellent. Your favorite dish in this region?
Anything with pumpkin. Okay. I'd say the tortelli alla zucca, because it's simple and classic and delicious, and I really enjoy the mix of the salty cheese with the sweet pumpkin. It's definitely a must try. And second favorite would be a spritz,
okay.
a cocktail.
And if you had to summarize this region in three words, what three words would you use?
Cultural,
okay.
delicious, and lively.
Okay. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Our guest again has been Gina Musio mm-hmm. from ginamusio.com. Gina, tell us about the most recent article you wrote about this region, and we'll put a link in it to the show notes.
Okay, yeah. I actually have an article about Mantova and the top places to see. It's just a quick look so that you can remember. And as well as an interactive timeline about the Verona Arena, if you're interested in more history on that.
Excellent. And if you'll send me those links, we can put those in the show notes so people can find them.
Perfect.
Thank you so much for coming on The Amateur Traveler, Gina, and sharing with us your obvious love for Italy, not to mention at certain Italians, but also your love for Mantua, Padua, and Verona.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
In news of the community, I wanted to give you some idea of my travel schedule in case you happen to be in one of the cities that I'm traveling to here over the rest of the year. You know about the amateur traveler trip to India. Hope you can join us with that. I'll also be in Israel here at the end of March. I'll be in Germany in the Black Forest the last week in April. In May, I'll be in Huntsville in the second week of the month. And then I think the fourth week of the month, I'll be in Raleigh in North Carolina. And then I'm home for the summer, I think, at least currently until August, when I head out on a Mediterranean cruise in parts around Spain. And then I'm in, I think, both Ireland and also New Mexico in October. And so if you're in any of those cities, oh, that's right, and over Labor Day in New York City, if you're in any of those cities and you have a chance to get together for a cup of coffee, let me know and maybe it will work out or maybe it won't, but at least like to give it a try. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. Join the Facebook group to join the conversation there, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Amateur Traveler. And thanks so much for listening.